Thank you. Just like I wrote it for him, he stuck to the script, you know. I got to say, I would not be standing here. It's funny how things work out. You know, we all of you are very successful, and what an impressive class. I looked through, and I was like, man, we have so many, Dave said, countries I've worked with in key throughout the region, and your resume and stuff, it's just fantastic. So I'm really honored to be here to talk to you. But like many of you who are so successful, you don't get there alone, and I would have never made it in a million years. And I can tell you for certain, I would not be standing here if it wasn't for the leadership of Dave Shanahan. I can tell you that, because he's absolutely right. I had some crazy ideas, and I think if I'd have worked for, there were like 10 other commanders up there I could have worked for, I would have been fired by any one of those. The guy named Jim Harai was up there too. He definitely would have fired me immediately. But Dave was very patient, put up with stuff, and taught me and helped me, and I would not be standing here without him. They probably got the wrong Brown anyway. It's a very common name, but if they didn't, I will say Dave Shanahan's been absolutely key. So what a great course. I got to tell you, I guess it shows when I was pretty excited when they said you're the senior graduate still on active duty. What that means is I'm an old son of a gun, you know, and I've been around a long time. But I will say I learned a ton here. This is a tremendous program. You're really smart to have come to this. I would have gone to this course had it been around and I had the ability to. But the courses I went to, I came into the Pacific coming out of Iraq and went to Indo-PACOM to be the XO to the Indo-PACOM commander. And it was interesting because the commander, he was busy and I had a little bit of time. He didn't really want me to come to the course. But I snuck my way in, and those days, I think it was 6 or 8 weeks. It was fantastic. And I learned a ton. And what I learned, I used every single day working with the combatant commander throughout the region. Every single day, no doubt about it. And I've used it ever since and tried to send as many people here as possible. So I would just say the other thing is I still am in touch everywhere I go. When I was in India last, good partner, General Singh, retired. You know, we met up. Everywhere I go, I look for the alumni. APCSS alumni, and we get together whenever we can, and it's an immediate bond. And of course, you tell a few stories about some of the funny professors and stuff like that. But you share all you learned, and you have an incredible bond. So it's a tremendous experience. I would just say, I know not everybody's in the course. Some of the people in the back aren't, but those in the course, it's a great course, and take advantage of it. So I really want to save time for questions more than anything. Nothing's worse, you know. Nobody ever said a general was never short words up here yakking at you. You know, generals can talk forever. So I'd rather just hit a few key points in crisis management from my perspective, having dealt with over the years, been about 38 years now in different leadership positions, really the last 9 years in a row in command. I feel very fortunate at different levels. And I've had all kinds of crisis occur. Because you can imagine, the most recent significant was North Korea. I am responsible for 100,000 U.S. Army soldiers in the Pacific, from Washington State, Alaska, Hawaii, Japan, Korea, Guam, Saipan, on and on and on, a few other places I left out, American Samoa. My responsibility was to train, prepare, equip those soldiers in case we had a crisis with North Korea. Now, no one was praying for peace more than myself and my soldiers. Of course, we want peace. No one wants a war. You'd have to be insane to want to go to war. War is hell. It is terrible. Having been there, it's terrible. So you don't want that. However, at the same time, what our nation asks military to do is defend and protect. So if something, you know, I don't know if Kim Jong-un at the time had shot a missile, well, we're going to defend and protect. We're not going to. So we had to be ready. And I will tell you, for various reasons, we weren't necessarily ready when this crisis started getting worse and worse, happened very quickly. It was kind of, you know, we knew we needed some things, but it was not necessarily the priority. You know, the situation had been around quite a long time. Those that were in harm's way immediately from terrorist threat or, you know, a situation in Afghanistan or Iraq, they were the higher priority. So obviously, you're not always the highest priority, but it shifted. And, you know, when we first started looking at the crisis and we did something that's very valuable as you're preparing for any type situation, and it was kind of assessing the situation thoroughly. And I know I see you've got everything from you know, how to look at the entire whole of government approach and look at all different tools to help you assess the situation. And we did that, and with North Korea, it was about 570 key areas we had issues. And I thought, oh boy, this is going to be tough. And the whole army was involved in this preparing. Well, after about 18 months of hard work, it was down to less than 50 issues. And we kind of, you figure out what you have to do, where, how, and when, pull together. And so we were and remain ready, but it's not easy. So that's a luxury today, though. The reason I bring that up first, where we had a little more time, thank goodness. It could have gone bad very quickly. We might not have had time. But most of the time, the difference today from just 10 years ago, 5 years ago, and it continues to go, is the incredible complexity in the world. When I was a young officer, or General Horai, or Colonel Dave Shanahan, you know, when we were young officers, the fog of war was not enough information. The fog of crisis was not enough information. Something happens, you don't know. You have a huge space. And that was difficult, but quite honestly, it was easier than today. What's the fog of war today? If it was not enough information, what is it today? Way too much information. I mean, ridiculous amount, overwhelming amounts of information. You have these haystacks, oceans of information, or haystacks of information, and you're trying to find the golden needle to help you make a decision in a crisis, whether that's humanitarian assistance crisis, whether that's, as I was describing, potential war with another nation state, or whether it's something anywhere in between, from an accident to a tsunami to a nuclear disaster, you name it, some crisis. The challenge now is overwhelming amounts of information, and the velocity of human interaction has risen to such a point, such a level, information diffuses so rapidly that it takes away decision space for the leadership. So in other words, you know, I mean, the simplest examples, I can send a tweet and it goes halfway around the world in seconds. Look at the impact of a tweet. You know, I mean, who would even known a few years ago what the heck a tweet was? You know, and you just go, what's a tweet? You know, now a tweet can go and it's on every outlet, everything instantly. So the challenge is, this is a huge, huge challenge, because what happens is, you know, one of the first things in a crisis is you don't want to overreact, right? You don't want to panic, because if you've been around for more than a couple of days, you'll know the first report is always wrong, right? Always wrong. It's an amazing thing. The first report comes in, and it's usually, you know, really, you know, I mean, I've seen crazy, you know, 300 people have died. Here's what happened. You're like, oh, my goodness. Well, you get the details, and no, wait, 300 people were being evacuated. They're safe. They're fine. You know, I mean, but it moves so rapidly. So these overwhelming amounts of information cause you incredible challenges. And as a decision maker, the first thing is really get the facts, find out what's going on. So back in the old days when there, you know, wasn't enough info, you had time to do that, and people respected that time. Take your time. We understand you don't have the info. Gather that info. It might take weeks. No problem. What's happened today? Did they give you a couple of weeks? Heck no. You're lucky if you get a couple hours. In fact, usually what happens in a crisis, it hits somewhere, a tweet, a text, a blog, a Facebook, something, somebody sees it, it's picked up, and you find out about it before you knew about it. In the old days, it would come up the chain of command, somebody, whether you're a government organization or an NGO or whether you're military, somehow you'd find out before. Now you usually are surprised. In fact, we have a thing we call, you know, black swans, and I know it's not a good analogy for New Zealand. Black swans in the United States, there's very few, you know, and so we say a black swan is something that comes out of nowhere that you didn't expect, a black swan. Like 9-1-1 was a black swan, you know, I mean, and even North Korea was a little bit of black. Nobody expected him to get that. Now in New Zealand, I know there are a lot of black swans. Whoops, there we are. New Zealand, a lot of black swans. So I always get the comment, that doesn't work for us. There's a ton of black swans, but there's white swans there too, so I don't know what the hell to do for you guys. You know, but there's also pink flamingos. What's a pink flamingo? Anybody know what that is? I know you know what a pink flamingo. When we say pink flamingo, what is it? That's something, okay, so black swan, something comes out of nowhere you don't expect. A pink flamingo is kind of like something that's always been there and sort of around, and then all of a sudden comes up and raises its head. So that's like North Korea is a perfect example. That's been there. We've been dealing with that for a long time. Then all of a sudden, very quickly, boom, it escalates. It was not a black swan out of nowhere, but it's a pink flamingo. So you're dealing with that, and it's very, very difficult. And what happens, I think the best example is humanitarian assistance, disaster response. And what you see, you know, that takes, when that happens, we usually get most of our info from sources outside, for example, for us, outside the government. It's local folks tweeting, blogging. It's sites that are out there that exist. Some of them you're going over in the class. I saw, you know, how you get info and pull info from all different sources. And so you're going to get all that info. You're going to be overwhelmed. But what happens in HADR is the expectations almost instantly are way up here. You know, whereas when very little information out there, I was involved in operations in Haiti, Bosnia, different operations, and you would have time to gradually figure out what to do, develop a plan the way you should resolve a crisis. You know, you're not rushing, you're finding out the actual facts, you're looking at estimates, what can you do? Well, the challenge today is that space is gone. So it forces you, there's some great tools to plan and operate, but you can't take the time you used to. You can use some of them, and I see you're going over some of them here, and that's good. But I'm just going to tell you, the challenge is you will be overwhelmed with others wanting to know info, the hunger for info. And then the other thing that happens is perception has changed. Perception has changed significantly. Again, you can shape perception. In the old days, you could take a long time to shape perception, and you'd be working things to shape the perception out there. Like, to say it's a disaster response, and you're trying to shape the perception that you're there, and you're very, you know, you're doing everything you can, and you had time to show what you were doing, supplies coming in, this is happening. Now perception is shaped almost instantly by things usually external to you, tweets, texts, blogs, online, Facebook, input from around, all over the place. Everybody, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of cameras, recordings, information overload. But what it does to you is you do not have the time. And guess what? Here's the worst part of that perception shaping. It can happen very quickly, the perception being shaped, and then it takes you a long time to recover from it. You're playing catch up. You know, we used to say it's a kind of an advantage the disaster has or an adversary has. You know, they can put something out and very quickly it can be believed, and you can't be first with the story anymore. You want to be first with the truth, but guess what? The truth takes time. And so those who are lying are always going to beat you if you're telling the truth, because you got to verify the truth. And here's what happens. Here's the worst part. If you're in any job where you're a leader in crisis management, is in this environment, you can be removed before you ever have a chance to even react. So I've seen it over and over again. I've seen, for example, a Secretary of the Army, and a blog shot comes in, a mold in a barracks, and sort of a crisis, and the individual, the secretary, is, okay, we're going to find out the truth, see what it is. It's, you know, let's not overreact. 2 days later, he's out of a job because it didn't show he cared. The perception immediately was he was not jumping on the issue right away to get after that crisis. And so your expectation out there, good news is in this course, you're learning all kinds of tools, all kinds of ways and relationships and so forth that's really going to help you. But here's the thing right from the beginning. If you don't almost overreact in the beginning, you're probably not going to be successful. There's a fine line. What is enough and what is you're short? So sometimes I'll have a scenario come up and I'll actually be very calm about it, find out what's going on, want to take my time, but I realize, if I do that, the perception is going to be I'm not taking enough action, and whether that's a perception of the public, whether that's a perception of leadership, whether it's a perception of those in harm's way, they want results quickly. And so you've got to show. And so sometimes, you know, you're trying to find out what will go on, but you will make decisions early to show and to make sure they know your intent and what's happening. Otherwise, you won't be there for the rest of the crisis. It's just a reality today. And unfortunately, the negative of that is you got to remember, especially if you're at the top, it rolls down. So if you're spinning at, you know, 100 miles an hour, the person below you is going 150, below that's going 250, and it can be out of control at the lower levels. So it's a real challenge. It's a huge, huge challenge. So, but you can overcome it. And the way to overcome it is courses like this and preparation, and it's education, training, and experience, that balance that's so key in a crisis. And that's why it's so important you invest when you go back to your countries and whatever your department is, whatever the crisis you may face, you want to form the relationship before the crisis, all right? Big mistake. You can't wait for a crisis to form a relationship. So why do you think I'm gone half of the year, just in the Philippines, being Thailand, just in China in November, and you're out there, you're building relationships in your area so that when a crisis hits, you're going to have to react quick, but you can with the relationships. No country here will do anything alone anymore, or they're foolish, they're crazy. You can't do it alone. It's too complex. And it's, first of all, it seems like the disasters are getting more complex, doesn't it? I mean, I remember when I was first Corps commander and you had the disaster, the terrible earthquake, tsunami, and nuclear disaster in Japan. And it was interesting, a few months before that, we were working with the Japanese Ground Self-Defense Force and looking at practicing a scenario. And one of them brought up a scenario with an earthquake, a tsunami, and a nuclear disaster, and you guess what happened? I said, that's unrealistic. That'll never happen. And a few months later, it happened. And so, you know, they are getting way more intense than ever before. And what I talked about, that velocity of human interaction makes them more complex because people are seeing images. And again, this, I'm talking mostly HADR, humanitarian assistance disaster response, but this could be a terrorist attack. This could be a nation, you know, again, a conflict, an accidental ramming of ships between countries, or planes getting too close. This could be a cyber attack on a government computer system. This could be a attack on the economic system by cyber. And the complexity, you want to talk about complexity, we got domains nobody even thought about before, cyber and space. We've always had domains we deal with, air, land, sea. Well, not always had air, but recently. I mean, air, since early 1900s, air came on board, so we get air, land, sea. But now we have the cyber and space. And they have a huge impact, the greatest impact of any domains. Why is that? Why would cyber have such a huge impact, greater than land, air, sea, on any scenario, any crisis? Why do you think that is?
Everything is tied into it, sir.
Yeah. I mean, it's connected, and it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And oh, by the way, probably the most significant reason, folks can do stuff on that, and you can't find out who it is. You can't trace it to a source. You can have a cyber attack. You think it came from this country, but they've manipulated, so it's seven countries. You don't know who it is, or a terrorist organization, or whoever. So this is very difficult, and the experts have a hard time with that. What's that? Yeah, it's the Internet of Things, which, when it came about, and if you look at, the billions of people, I think I have go to the slide with the, I think this is an interesting slide. Go to the next slide. Who's got that? Okay, keep going. Okay, this is the Internet connectivity in 2004. The brightness is who's connected on the Internet, 2004. Now go slide forward. Wow, 2014, 10 years later. It's even brighter now. 2004, go back one, to 2014. And we don't think people are connected, and this Internet of Things, and that is growing. They're saying here within a few years, well, we passed a point in 2008 that was fascinating. More people connected to the Internet than on Earth. More things, I'm sorry, not people, things connected to the Internet than people on Earth in 2008. Huge crossover. So before that, we had fewer things than people. Now, and that's doubling, tripling, and growing at monumental speed. That impacts every crisis everywhere. Because again, I often say when I was way back, 38 years ago when I was commanding a platoon of 32 soldiers, if everything they had done would hit the internet, I wouldn't be standing here, I guarantee you. They did some things that were unbelievable back then in the early 80s. And I was like, holy smokes, thank God. I was, luckily it'd be local news and maybe somebody would hear about it, maybe they wouldn't. Now everybody knows about it. All right, so it changes how, and I was talking about the key for you all as you go back, because of this complexity, that's why you have to have the great balance. It's not all education, but that's a key part of it. Education like you're getting here, that's a key part of it. It's experience also, and then it's the training, and the balance of those three is key. And if you're not doing that, building those relationships beforehand, everything we solve will be multilateral now. And I can remember 15 years ago saying the Pacific will be multilateral, and people would say I was crazy. Oh no, it's bilateral, it'll always be bilateral. Never have a NATO-like structure, and I agree, it won't ever have a NATO-like structure. But ASEAN is getting pretty close. It's growing and having a bigger impact, and multilateral is everywhere. Everything we do military-wise now is multilateral except with China, because they're just not interested. It's bilateral with them still. They're not interested in multilateral. I mean, they come to some HADR events that are multilateral. Like, we have Mongolia here, Conquest in Mongolia, Cobra Gold in Thailand, HADR, that's multilateral with them. But everything else, no, they won't do it. But everybody else is multilateral. And even, I was just with, we have the Indian Army Chief here. I was just with him. We're having a meeting here over the next couple days talking about India, U.S., And India was probably the greatest example I know where they were all bilateral. In fact, last time I was there, they're bragging about 99 bilateral relationships. And I said, that's old think, because bilateral is old. You've got to be multilateral, solve these complex problems, no matter what they are, from terrorism to HADR to full-blown conflict and accidental conflict. You've got to get at a multilateral, multinational, whole-of-government approach. So if you're not training that, if you're not working that, educating and working the experience in that, when the crisis happens, it's going to be a mess, no matter what it is, whether it's cyber against banking or whether it's, we kind of changed when we were working, how do we have to adjust to this complexity? We used to say that we needed leaders who were comfortable in ambiguity and chaos, comfortable. And we had a saying, we would, back in the early 2000s, mid-2000s, we'd say, comfortable being uncomfortable. And because all these things happen. Comfortable isn't good enough for all the reasons I've been talking about. Comfort is too slow. And the situation you're dealing with, most of the disaster is not comfortable. It's chaos. And the terrorists that you may deal with are thriving in chaos because they can use this first time in history, I would tell you, that those that would do any of us harm can leverage technology better than we can in many cases. Not always, but in many cases, better than we can. Why would that be? That goes back to the thing I mentioned earlier. They don't have to worry about telling the truth. When you tell the truth, this is slower because you got to get the facts. When you're willing to lie and work, and you don't care if it's the truth, you can work pretty rapidly spreading a lie. If you're trying to tell the truth, it takes time to verify. And you're going to verify because you want to make sure you tell the truth. So so we now say that leaders have to thrive in ambiguity and chaos. From comfort to thrive in ambiguity and chaos. And that may sound like big deal. What's the difference? Huge difference in that education, training, and experience. So you need more complex exercises, more complex training, more complex education. Look at your course here. It's a great one. It's very complex, the things you're going over. Across the whole of government and all the stuff you're going over, but that's perfect because that's what you need. And if you don't have, you're not going to thrive, you're going to be behind big time and fail. And that's whether it's saving lives in HADR or whether it's preventing your country from being attacked or whether it's recovering from a terrible crisis, that somebody could do to your nation in cyber or your particular area. So that's the good news is, I have never seen cooperation and collaboration like we're seeing now because we all know this. Well, I shouldn't say all. Some don't know it, but the majority of nations in the Pacific know. And when you look at the Pacific, it's really an impressive example now of where the rules-based international order since World War II free and open Indo-Pacific, rules-based international order has led to the most prosperous region in the world, and incredible prosperity. 7 fastest growing economies in the world. And that's, you know, and there are those that argue, well, okay, that's work, but maybe some adjustments need to be made. Maybe, but they aren't adjustments that prevent free and open or where it's on your own rules. That doesn't work. You know, so that's been great with free and open, rules-based international. Welcome, open to everybody, by the way. Unlike some other ideas where, you know, it's not open to everybody. It's advantageous to some and not others. But free and open is to everybody. It doesn't say, no, we don't want Russia or China, or we don't want this. No, it's everybody. If you follow, you know, and that has benefited everybody significantly. So that's really key. And that has led to where we cooperate and collaborate more now than ever before. And that's also, again, you know, say right up front is, you know, you look at, that's with folks like China. For us, you know, we do the largest exercise, U.S. Army Pacific, for the U.S. with China, Disaster Management Exchange. We're on our 15th iteration. 1 year we do it in China, 1 year we do it in the U.S. And I was just there last November, we did it in China. And it's tremendous. We do it humanitarian assistance, disaster response focused. But one example of progress there, for example, when the Nepal earthquake happened, a terrible earthquake, and many nations joined in, and you know, it was really, kind of makes you proud, really everybody except North Korea was helping, you know, and hopefully one day North Korea will come on board and help as well. But everybody was helping save lives. However, China came in, and they wouldn't be part of the National Military Coordination Center. They were just on their own. And quite honestly, they were causing more disruption than good. I mean, they didn't want to be part of the, where does water need to go, where does fuel need to go, and everybody working together and with the experts, whole of government, multi-agency, multinational approach. They were off on their own and really kind of causing more. So we, over the last 2 disaster management exchanges, have worked with them about being part of the National Military Coordination Center in the disaster and showing them what it does and working it and exercises, and now they agreed to do it. So it'll save more lives. So those type of things are really important. But again, that's getting at the complexity, the speed, thriving in ambiguity and chaos well before the crisis happens, or you're going to fail. If you wait for the crisis, it's too late to form relationships. There's too much chaos going on, and it's at a speed that is undeniable, unstoppable. So you got to work together. And the good news, again, for all of us, can rest a little easier that we are working together extremely well across the Pacific, Indo-Pacific. Better than any region I've ever been in. Now, I've been mostly in the Pacific, but I've also been in Europe. I was chief of staff over there for U.S. Army Europe, and deputy NATO. I mean, you know, different. I've been different, lots of different places, Middle East, everything. We are working together better, and we need to keep it going because, unfortunately, tragically, you know, just for HADR, for example, 7 out of 10 people in the world that die of a disaster, it's in the Pacific, Indo-Pacific, because of the rim of fire and the conditions we have. So I think I'll stop there. That's probably enough for a lunchtime talk. And